Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Welcome to Big Pop Fun, the podcast with your host, Tom Wilson, and guests from every corner of places that, you know, Tom has been and who he asked to be on his show. Brought to you by Tom's Art at BigPopFun.com. Moving pictures to make you happy. Hey, support the arts by buying art. Big Pop Fun. Tom, life, showbiz, people. Here's Tom.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Big Pop Fun podcast with Tom Wilson. I am Tom Wilson, bringing you big things like myself and pop things occasionally and fun things. It's always fun at least 51% of the time, and that's over half. So, hey, thanks for being here. Thanks for you first-timers. Welcome. And for you people who've been here before, you gluttons for punishment, welcome back to another episode of Big Pop Fun, this magical sleigh ride. I don't know why I keep doing it, people. It's become kind of a catchphrase, hasn't it? Because now people, you know, people comment on it or people email me about the magical sleigh ride. I only said it once, and then I said it again just because I thought I couldn't think of anything else to say. So I said that thing that I said last week about the thing, and then somebody commented on it. So I was like, oh, I guess I have to. So I'll keep doing it for a while. I think we're, I don't know, are we almost done with the magical sleigh ride thing? Well, hey, we're going to try it. And here we go, magical sleigh ride, take one. Welcome back to a magical sleigh ride of enchantment and wonder as we glide on tufts of winter wonderland white in the crisp air of a new year, a new chapter, a new life, every day an invitation to take a deep breath and breathe in freedom and possibility and breathe out that, the earlier sleigh ride that we were on last New Year's, where we thought we were breathing in freedom and possibility, but we were really breathing in, exhaust fumes from our own chugging bus full of our own needy, egotistical demands that must be met before we'll lower ourselves to silly practices like freedom and forgiveness and gratitude or watching the sun shining on a frozen pond as children lace their skates. I'm really losing my marbles on the magical sleigh ride now, but children do lace their skates on frozen ponds all across America. And even Canada, because I hear it gets cool in Canada too, and they have ice there. But skates have just been brought up to Canada, where they're thinking of a game called hockey. How did it become named hockey? Not all that inviting if you think about it. But hey, I laced my skates as a young man in Pennsylvania. We would it was so frozen one year. We actually played ice hockey with skates, skating on the street in front of my house. But we would go to Eastern College, now Eastern University, there in the suburbs of Philadelphia, and lace up our hockey skates and go out and play hockey on the little pond. It wasn't quite a little pond. It was a sizable pond there that would freeze over. And man, I'm a parent now, but we were done. Just the insanity of boys. It's just crazy. We would have our skates on and be playing hockey and everything. And of course, the hockey game would be over and the ice would be sort of chewed up by our skates. And then we would play a ridiculous game. I'm not even kidding, where, I don't know, a dozen of us, maybe more, would start skating closer and closer towards each other until the combined weight was enough to begin cracking the ice, and then we would all scramble. yes, not very bright at all, is it? It's just like, what were we thinking? But I remember we really would do that. You would get closer and closer to each other. So the combined weight was this gigantic human bowling ball on top of the ice. And then, but the, I must admit, the crack, it sounded so cool. I guess we liked the sound of that crack when the ice just this big. And then as soon as that crack happened, we everyone would scram, you know, fly away from each other, spreading out so the ice wouldn't break. Because then Christopher Walken shows up and he's having the whole thing with Martin Sheen where he's holding his arm and the ice is going to break. I don't even do a good Christopher Walken. Sorry about that. And most of you haven't seen The Dead Zone, so right over your heads. But welcome back to another Big Pop Fun brought to you by art. Please go out and support artists around you. Support every, go to an art show and buy a little something or buy a piece of jewelry, but just buy, go to Etsy. Look at something that someone crafted from their own ideas or their own little stuff. And, you know, people make fun of it very easily because, of course, it's easy to marginalize and to make fun of people who make little things and try to sell them. Hey, but they're human beings. Those things are not made by a robot. I think they should have shirts or, you know, maybe in the future we'll have to actually have a barcode tattooed on our forehead with the stenciling, not a robot. But anyway, buy some art, support the arts, and buy my book, The Masked Man, which is still out there, still in the top 100 of the Kindle comedy books. Everyone's been enjoying it very much, so please go check it out. Tom Wilson is my name, and The Masked Man is the name of the book for Kindle or iPad on the iPad store or Nook in the Barnes & Noble store. The holidays have gone, and I'm not, I never wanted to, I have to introduce my guest, I know, but the, I just have to – I don't want to be the complaining guy, and I don't want to be the guy, you know, oh, this is my complaint for the month. What's with these people? Although it worked for Jay Leno when Jay was first on David Letterman's show, when it was late night, and Jay would have a, what's my beef, Dave? But I don't want to do that. But what I did notice over the holiday season was the exasperation that I inspired in people when I was – actually trying to do something nice. It just seems, maybe it's just Los Angeles, or maybe it's around this country. I hope it's just Los Angeles. But going shopping and in the mall, and I'm a large person. I'm 6'3", weigh, you know, 160, 165. But I, being a gentleman, I will try to give the other person, the person coming toward me, or the person, we're in an intersection at one of those department stores where I'm going through the makeup section, but I'm trying to get to shoes, and the lady is coming across the other way, and I stop in my tracks in order to give her the opportunity to go wherever she would like. And she has stopped in front of me, and I do that sort of gentlemanly wave with my hand. I don't say anything, but with a slight smile, like, wherever, you know, you would like to go, miss, please feel free. And they, it happened like three times. They go like, oh, oh, and then they go. They do this exasperated, like, oh, geez. And I didn't even know what it was for. I mean, I had stopped. I didn't bowl them over. I didn't elbow them in the neck in order to get to shoes. I was doing the gentlemanly thing. And their exasperation really was kind of saying, like, oh, why do you exist? Oh, here's another one of those human beings in my way again. But I wasn't in their way. And it's happened with cars, too. Cars in the parking lot. And you're giving them the opportunity. You stop. And wave them on. And they act like it's, they can't make a decision for a second. And then they do, oh, like with their hand. Oh, you other car who stopped and was trying to be nice to me. You existence that I'm recognizing as bad. Anyway, so I'm trying not to be exasperated with anyone. And I'm certainly not exasperated with you for listening to my long, boring story about people's mystery exasperation toward me. Pat Fraley's my guest this week, and Pat's a very interesting guy with a master of fine arts in acting from Cornell University. And as everyone in the professional theater, professional entertainment industry knows, that to go to such a fine institution as Cornell and get a master's degree in acting, what you do is you come to Los Angeles and you bring your sheepskin, you bring that certificate around, your diploma, and you go in and you show it to people. You say, I've got a master's degree, Cornell University. And they say, pardon me, your piece of paper is blocking my view of myself in the mirror behind you. So, but it is quite an academic achievement, and Pat is certainly a smart and experienced guy. We met doing voiceovers a number of years ago on a show. I believe we met on Wing Commander Academy, where I was acting, and it was such a I talk about it with Pat, so I'll go over it briefly here, but it was a really creative and wonderful environment where people, the actors in the show, would be very, very improvisational and funny and goofy and off the wall before the take, and then come in and zero in on something that was very, very concentrated. Interestingly to me, the freedom of play before the take actually fueled the concentration while we were in the take. But one day I bring up in my conversation with Pat, Jessica Walter, who had come. Jessica Walter, a woman of very, very long resume and very serious acting, and studied up, you know, in New York, I'm sure, and did many things. She starred in Play Misty for Me. She was the kind of psychotic radio listener in the Clint Eastwood movie Play Misty for Me. You would know her as she was played that mom in Arrested Development. You would definitely recognize her. She's a very famous actress. And she had come in for one of these voiceover sessions, as many actors do, as I began my voiceover career doing. You know, the actor coming in from live theater, television, movies, and coming to do a voiceover session. So Jessica came in. She was not enamored at all with that work environment of the free form, improvisational, whacked out preparation into the take. And Pat and I, who knows what we were doing? We were doing some improvisation of two Ukrainians who had just come back from a Mars mission. Who knows what it was? But Jessica didn't appreciate it at all, and looked in the booth with the director and the producers and said, I can't hear what they're saying, and I can't work under this with this kind of thing. And Pat and I, of course, when people do that and you're a goofball, immediately you turn into a seventh grader. And then we're covering our mouths, trying to stop giggling, practically running out of the room. But she did her, she had her preparation and her method and her instrument, and we had ours, and hey, they came together that one day, and it was beautiful. I think it's the weakest introduction I've ever done. I really hope you enjoy my conversation with the lovely and talented Pat Fraley. Pardon me, I lost my voice, it was so bad. Pat Fraley.
It's Big Pop Fun.
Cowboy Tom!
Pat Fraley is with me today, and I've never done this, Pat. I've never actually come to the guy's house, and he actually happens to have a studio at his house. So he says, oh, well, let's do it on my equipment with my expensive microphones and everything.
Now, you know, I got to tell you, you're probably thinking that you're special, but with Rob Paulson, we went to a studio. Buzzies.
Oh, you went to literally went
we
to a
literally
studio.
We went to a studio.
In order
so
to
you're
do
sort
Rob's.
Of like, I'm
low. Oh, no. I'm not even close to Rob Paulson and
Who is?
His podcast
Who
and
is?
His whole deal.
Talking Tunes.
Talking Tunes is Rob's podcast, which
he's,
I
yeah,
have
got
not.
It.
He was the guy. I asked him to be on my podcast, you know, a long time ago now. Yeah. Hey, Rob, I'm doing this thing. Well, what is that? Well, it's a podcast where now people are sort of programming their own radio station and they listen to things they're interested in. Really? And how do you do that? Well, I record it myself, Rob, and everything. So
80,000 listeners
yeah,
he's got to
cut to, like, Less than a month later, Phil LaMarr, who you know and I know, a wonderful, wonderful actor, I email Phil, hey, would you like to be on my back? He says, oh, yes, I will, but I'm doing Rob Paulsen's podcast. So I'm doing, what? What? So Rob goes off, thanks, Tom. Let me, you know, make Rob's Talking Tunes podcast. And now, 800 million people have listened. And he goes on these seminars and cities and all that stuff.
If I had a podcast, it would be rather like what Brad Garrett once told me. He said he had a show that was so bad doing stand-up in the South that he said, I didn't hear crickets. I heard them thinking. I became the cricket whisperer. That's what would happen with me.
Yeah. So you, I've come up into your lair here. You're the upper part of your lovely home because we are very close to the Hollywood Bowl. You could be strapped to one of the Beach Boys' backs in their 50th anniversary.
Telling you, there's nothing like walking a block to the Hollywood Bowl.
Did you used to go to the bowl, or do you go to the bowl?
Oh,
I mean, you literally can park here and walk to the bowl from here.
I could make so much more money by doing parking outside. Get a flashlight,
exactly.
Whip them in.
But you're not from here, are you? I mean, we've come up to your lair, which is, we've got to say, your lair up here, it's as if the Western artist Frederick Remington exploded up here.
Yeah, it's like a villa. I wake up and go, and everything I ever had, like old antlers and
It's just antlers and wood and cowboys
canoe,
and Indian paintings.
Canoe skins. And
you have
my grandpa's
a canoe skin that is painted in like Native American symbols.
Yeah.
That is – now, what is that?
Well, my grandpa was the superintendent of the Deaf and Blind School in Gooding, Idaho.
Is that where you're from?
No. But I spent a great deal of time in Idaho. I was reared in Seattle and Bainbridge Island and Bremerton, right in the peninsula in that area. And but I spent a lot of time in Idaho. And so I had this whole – I was in it, not of it. So I'd go to Idaho and I was a cowboy.
Uh-huh.
And so I really have a heart for that. My grandfather bought a ranch in the Sawtooths in the 40s for like, you know, $2,000 or you bucked a guy's hay for it. 160 acres in the Sawtooth Valley. So that has come down to us, the kids.
And was it raised cattle or farm kind of
cattle? Thing? We would lease it out for cattle because we have an agricultural easement. So we have to have manure. And even though I have four boys, better to have the cows.
Yes, cows.
But we had to move the cows out because they moved in the endangered wolves. And they sort of like veal, right? And you can't shoot them. They have to be 30 feet away before you can shoot them. Well, you know, forget that. A wolf. So now they've learned how to pack hunt. They won't take down horses. So now we lease it for 50 head of horse.
So wolves will not kill horses?
Well, they're big. They're too big.
Oh, they're too big.
If they learn how to pack more than – or pack hunt more than they are. I mean, they're taking down buffalo in Yellowstone.
Now,
because they learned how
– hey, look, if we did this together, you know, we can always have a buffet.
So those new wolves that have repopulated – They've learned how to work as a pack.
Yeah,
better.
You know, come on. Let's think – let's synthesize.
Wolf synthesizing. So grandpa had to stop raising cattle – because of the wolf population.
Well, he was gone by then, but we always had
Do the family still has the ranch?
Yeah. It's all us, and we incorporate it so it can never be sold, divided, or anything. So it's a beautiful place. It hasn't changed since the 50s. There's no – I don't have – my cousin has a place on it with propane and a well. I have no running water. And I have no electricity. So I have a 180-year-old log cabin.
Up
and that's
in
where
Idaho.
We go.
You go there for vacation?
Renee drops us off, goes to the hotel, and I lose boy by boy every night until we have to go home.
Because everyone's going back to the hotel.
Because everyone who doesn't know why does not want to sleep in old Sleep 6.
Uh-huh.
Except me.
Do you and why do you like to sleep there? Why that whole rustic thing?
Well, it's just a shower of all my days as a boy. You know, I started going in the early 50s as a little boy. And you talk about, you know, when never was heard a discouraging – or seldom was heard a discouraging word, you know, from
home on the ranch. And the skies are not cloudy all day.
I'm telling you, in all my life with my wife before we had children and when I was a boy, no one has ever had an argument that I ever heard on that land. And it's not spooky. It's just never happened. So can you imagine going to some place where you've never had a bad memory?
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. It sure is.
And Home on the Range is really actually a beautiful song, isn't it?
Yeah, it
is. Give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play.
Have you ever heard the Mormon Tabernacle version of that?
No, I haven't. Can you sing it for me right now?
You know Frank Welker can.
Yeah.
It's a lot of contracts.
Frank Welker, for those who don't know, one of the most famous and celebrated of voiceover artists so many years, and a great guy.
But like Lou Schreimer said, he said, you know, he can do any animal in the world. He can't do humans. You ever see Fred on Scooby-Doo?
Yeah, sure.
Well, Verna, where do we go from here?
And then, of course, there'd be some wild monster, and it'd be like, you know, amazing.
But it's a talent, and he can do it. He can do – they will say, cut – wait a minute, Frank. Hey, Frank, could you make it – this wolf is from Eastern Europe, and it's limping on its rear right leg because it's been in a leg hold trap, but it got out.
And it has a fever blist.
And can you do it like that? And you say, oh, my God, he did it. He actually did it.
I once heard him do a rain bird in a field going and hitting an oak tree around. Yeah. He used to do.
You mean the rain bird, the thing that waters the grass?
Then the other thing is, I once asked him, I said, Frank, give me your, because I'd heard him before, but I forgot. Give me your film projector, because that's such an anachronism in this day, and we're both the same age. And he said, 8 or 16. And he does 8mm and 16mm projector.
Man, oh, man. So Grandpa decided to be a rancher, or was he always
– He was a cowboy wannabe. He had studied to teach the deaf in 1907 at Gallaudet College, which was highly unusual in those days that someone that wasn't hearing impaired studied with the deaf. And he was very popular on the basketball team because the opposing team all assumed they were all deaf. My grandfather would sidle over and they'd be going, okay, I'm number 47, go over in the garden. And he'd like be signing behind his back to
their plans with the other
players. And so he was very popular. And then he started teaching the deaf in North Dakota at the state school and then moved, I believe, in the 30s to Idaho. And he was a wood carver too.
Was a family member deaf, or was it just?
Well, his older brother Frank had taught the deaf, and he got him into that track.
Huh.
Got him into teaching the deaf.
And what were you close with Grandpa?
Oh, very close. He was a great influence on my life. My father grew up without a father. His dad, my father Harry Fraley, his dad died when he was four. And this was double whammy, you know, the depression in the South, mm-hmm. No father.
Right.
So he really didn't know how to do dad stuff. He'd look at magazines, go, I guess I ought to wear that. And he didn't know about tools. I mean, where's the pliers?
We're in the backyard.
Really? Yeah, what did your dad do for a living?
He sold cars.
Oh, okay.
He was a Ford salesman. Hence, I have a boy named Ford Fraley. We found, you know, some relative that was named Ford later. But really, I named him. It was great because we'd drive along when he was a little boy. We'd get behind a pickup and he'd go, Dad, look.
My name.
My car. Uh-huh.
So you just saw Grandpa when you would go out to Idaho then?
Actually what happened, that was a connection there when I was very young. But when I was about 9 years old, he moved to Seattle. He retired. And I got to see him at least three times a week, sometimes four. I'd always spend the weekends with him.
And did he live like you do now in your office? I mean, did he have the Western lore and the garb and the
– Well, my grandmother, whose name was Nevada Driggs.
Nevada Driggs. Yeah. Boy, is that a great name.
Yeah. She was I got to tell you about how she got her name. But he was only allowed to have Western stuff in the basement.
Because Nevada Driggs wouldn't allow the Western
stuff?
If your name is Nevada Driggs, you got to allow some Spurs in the house.
Well, she did, but downstairs. Oh. So my grandfather, I grew up around a lot of, you know, paraphernalia, and he was a woodcarver, so I was around tools and stuff. But I got to tell you about how my grandmother got her name. The Driggs family is a huge patriarchal Mormon family. I have such a wealth of background and I love my ancestry from the Mormons. I'm not a Mormon. I'm a Christian now, but I love my family and all of the genealogy. And what happened was my grandmother was born in the 1880s, and she remembered hiding under the porch because Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid were coming to town. I mean, truly. But here's how it went. She, both my grandparents were of 21 children and polygamous family, families, the principal, as they called it. Well, just before my grandmother was born, they outlawed what they called the principal, bigamy, you know, two wives. So good Mormon still keeps his second wife, and my grandmother was the daughter of the second wife. So they took a squaw, and my great-grandmother took went down in a buckboard over to the territory in Nevada so she wouldn't be on record to be born. So they named her Nevada. Now,
with a squaw with like an Indian woman,
yeah,
on a buckboard wagon.
Right, but she split, you know, she got a little bored. But anyway, she had the baby, came back. 15 months later, it comes up in court in Utah. And during the court proceedings, someone says, is this the father of your daughter? And they ask. During the court proceedings, my grandmother said, Dada, and he went to prison.
He went to prison for her saying Dada.
Well, they go, well, apparently that's the father.
And so did she go with Nevada, or did everyone just kind of start calling her Nevada?
Oh, it was Grandma Bada. And I never called her Nevada. I called her Grandma, but people called her Nevada. Once in a while, they call her Alice, her middle name, but really, she was Nevada.
She didn't live in Nevada, though. But,
no.
I mean, after that.
No, she was reared in Utah, as was my grandfather, Pleasant Grove.
My dad was raised in an orphanage during the Depression, as people on the podcast know, again.
And so was my dad, by the way. When he lost his dad, he went into an orphanage.
Yeah, both dads.
Couldn't afford him.
This was in Philadelphia, but just because the lady was named Nevada, there was a lady from the orphanage who everyone called Texas, and I never knew why. And years and years later, as an adult, I asked my mom, well, was she from Texas or anything? And my mom said, no, she just always loved Texas. She just had, you know, like that cowboy life and sort of had – and was from the orphanage in Philadelphia and had these ideas of the, you know, the wide open prairie or whatever. But she never went to Texas, had never been to Texas, but everybody called her Texas.
That's like the play A Thousand Clowns, which Barry Gordon, my friend, starred in as a boy. And he played the kid where he would change his name every week. What do you like? What are you this week? Chevrolet. I like it.
Yeah.
Just, I would love to be able to pick my nickname. Did you ever get a nickname when you were a kid?
My dad, no, not really.
What'd your dad call you?
Not good nicknames. I got plenty of nicknames, Pat. Plenty of nicknames at school. But let's not go there.
No, let's not. What'd your dad call you?
My dad, when I was very little, he called me Bird, the Bird.
Really?
Because I guess I looked like the Bird or a bird or something.
My dad called me Southpaw. I'm left-handed.
Really?
And that's Southpaw, lefty.
Lefty.
Yeah.
Are you left-handed?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Southpaw,
so
lefty.
So Southpaw, sure. Yeah. My dad, but that stopped very early in life.
Right.
And then some, for some strange reason in high school, some people from my Spanish class called me Paco. I'm not even kidding. I don't know. The teacher, the Spanish teacher at school, she looked at me. She says, you do not look like a Tomas. I would call you.
Is Paco nickname for Tomas?
I don't think so. I don't think it is.
They just called you Paco.
But she goes,
you didn't look like
Paco.
A Tomas.
So from that,
I was hoping I didn't look like a Patricio.
Right. But for those, whatever, 30 people in that class, for the rest of high school, they called me Paco.
Sorry.
How did you You didn't start in voiceover, did you?
No.
I mean, you started on stage somewhere.
I did.
Where, up in Seattle?
Well, I started, yes, in high school.
Oh, so you got the bug?
Well, here's what happened. I don't remember a time in my life, Tom, that I wasn't going to be a performer.
Really?
Yeah, I can't remember, you know, jet airplane or a cowboy. It was performing.
Huh.
Before I even knew what that was, I'd see Red Skelton, and I went, oh, I like that. And what I think it was all based on a neurosis. Because I wanted to control my life even before there was anything wrong with the family. My parents were later divorced. And I'm sorry. Anyway, before.
But was it a kid trying to get away from that? Was it kind of a loud divorcey thing?
Was no,
it loud
well, house? it was later. But as a little boy, I loved the idea of having my own little characters. I loved Red Skelton having San Fernando Red and Freddie the Freeloader. I was drawn to that. And then later, I think it was exacerbated. Is that right? Is that the right word? For it when my parents were divorced when I was about 12. And then I really took to recording. My dad got me a recorder. In those days, they were like expensive.
Like a reel-to-reel.
Reel-to-reel. Mm-hmm. But I told him I needed to study at school. And, of course, what I'd do was I'd call bars, and I had a very high voice. And I'd go, is Mommy there? And they go, what's the name of your mother?
Mommy.
Just a sec. Hey, does anybody have a kid named calling in for Mommy?
Stevie?
No, somebody go,
What's the matter? Where's the babysitter? She's on fire. You're not Stevie.
Oh, so you were doing that stuff?
Oh, yeah. I'd call prank calls and record them and loved it. And I'd call someone and say, I'm a 5-year-old and I'm in a telephone booth and I don't know where I am. It was, I just loved that and realizing I could make people feel things while performing. And I always loved to be in a lot of costume and makeup. I mean, there's not enough nose putty or crepe wool for me. You know, I'd always think, I'll put a hunchback in there and I'll talk with an indescribable dialect. And then when I'm on stage, nobody will recognize me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've often thought that if actors get into performance to reveal or hide, and I was a hider.
Mm-hmm.
And if you stay in there long enough, you start to be able to reveal more while you're hiding. That's what happens with character actors. I can reveal more personally about myself while I'm in a dialect or a character than just me or doing a character that's very similar to me. But I started in high school because the only place you could get into performing, and this is in the 60s, they didn't have stand-up comedy clubs or any alternative. All you had was theater. So I got into theater, went all the way through college, got a Master of Fine Art in acting at Cornell, emigrated to Australia to do Shakespeare.
Really?
And it's there where somebody called and said, oh, yeah, do you have anybody that can do a Jimmy Cagney accent? And they're like, oh, yeah, we got a Yankee at a company. They figure we sit around in bars and going, hey, do Betty Davis,
right.
I'll do you doing Humphrey Bogart.
But what, if I may ask, what sent you to Australia from Cornell? I mean, Masters of Fine Arts in what, theater, acting?
Yeah, acting, professional acting.
From Cornell, that's quite a thing. But, boy, that's a long canoe trip with Granddad's canoe
to Australia. But I'll tell you, in those days, you know, people were graduating from Yale and Cornell, and they either went to the city, and I'm a Westerner. They'd either go to New York and pound the streets, and I just had no interest in that. And it was very dark in the early 70s when I got out. New York was really dark.
Yeah, and I lived there. Well, later 70s, but it was.
Well, in the 70s, it was definitely, I would, you know, sometimes walk down the street, and there would get some guys were coming toward me, and I'd act crazy, like David.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'd spittle would come out.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And they'd leave me alone.
It's tough to describe to people what Times Square was actually like before it became a shopping mall.
It was frightening. And people, you know, when they say, yeah, I miss the old New York. Oh, do you remember Times Square?
Exactly.
It was like Peep Show International. But so my alternative was to go to a regional theater company. Well, there was just no work.
So Australia just had jobs. Australia was like, I can make money there.
Well, no, here's what happened. I thought, where else do they speak English than America? England, but I can't get in. I knew you couldn't get a green card in there. So I looked around. I went, well, Australia. Well, they speak English, sort of, right? Mm-hmm. So I went to the Australian Consulate General in New York, went down to the little tourist library, and I said, can I have a list of theaters? And she goes, well, we don't have one, do we? Let's make one, mate. So for a couple hours, we created a list of all the theaters in Australia. I went back to Cornell up in Ithaca, and I made little tapes of me doing a couple monologues. And I sent them out, and I got a couple bites. And one was a small state-subsidized theater in Adelaide, South Australia. And in those days, you had to immigrate to work. And so I emigrated into Australia. Now, there were only three Americans there, Mel Gibson, me and Gus Mercurio, an old busted-out fighter, and Mel was still in school. And so I was the only young American in theater, in acting, in the whole country.
Wow. So what is that desperation to perform?
Yeah, exactly.
What is that?
Well, what it is I had no career, and I had no fear. I had no fear. I was not brought up with fear. I was brought up with a great deal of encouragement. In fact, I got to tell you the story about how I got into Cornell, because it's better than Australia. I had to audition to get into the Master of Fine Arts programs at Yale, Temple,
yeah.
Circle in the Square.
I almost went to Temple.
Cornell.
To Temple's program before I became a clown.
I almost did too.
And started driving a Volkswagen at the circus. I really did. It was really like, I have this offer to go to the MFA program at Temple and theater, or hang out with these guys at stand-up clubs and write my own shows and just, you know, live by the seat of my pants and write jokes with stubby pencils next to ice machines. And I went, yeah, I'll do that.
I know. It's like, oh, great. Clown actor. Clown
exactly.
actor.
Exactly.
Yeah, I actually thought about going to the Barnum and Bailey School out of Cornell.
Did I. Yeah, as did I.
I don't. But, what are we thinking?
But you went to Cornell.
No, here's what happened. I had to audition for all these schools, and hoping that I would get into an MFA program, which was the way to study acting back in the early 70s. So I'm in the dorm room, and I'm a senior in high school. I have to go back, and I've gotten a ticket to go to all these places in the East. This is in Walla Walla, Washington. And I have to play I had to have a classic monologue. So I picked this thing from The Changeling by Thomas Middleton, a Jacobean play, because they had to be classic. And so it called for this scarred, antihero with a face that's all scarred and messed up on one side. And here I am, I look face like a peach. I was 22, and I looked like I was 18. I've always looked younger than I am. And so I got this idea to get scotch tape and put it around my head and pull it down on one side of my face and wrap it around my neck and put it in my pocket. And I looked really – because I knew I couldn't act makeup.
Sure.
So here I go back.
Why not?
I go back and I audition at all these places and put scotch tape on my face. I got into every program. They only took 6 in Cornell. They paid a living wage and tuition. And I thought, oh, I must be really good for years until I went, wait a minute. I started teaching. They looked at me and said, if this kid will put scotch tape on his face, he'll do anything we tell him to do.
So really, but that's a gutsy move.
It's a gutsy move if you know the rules and you have – or if you have fear. But I didn't know the rules and I had no fear. And so I can just put that on my parents.
Is it innate or is it parents? Is it something that you learned?
I think I think that fear is something definitely you learn.
So the lack of fear is there, is innate.
Yes, and that's part of encouragement. I mean, I grew up in a household where they go, Pat, go get the tea cozy, put it on your head and do your Chinese man.
Right.
I was encouraged to perform and do stuff that was – I mean, and also my mom and I, after my father had left and we didn't have a lot of money, we'd get depressed, so we'd dress up the cat, And so dressing up and doing strange things was part of my background. So I guess that fed into it. But to answer your question, of course you can't say whether it's genetics or the way you rear a child, but it's certainly the encouragement that I had all the way down the pike and the lack – not taught guilt – I was never taught through guilt of anything and not fear. I'm going to jump off that tree into the water. We live on the water. Okay, whatever. It was never like, oh, you could break your neck. You could poke your eye out.
Well, I'm interested in that fear, because when I've talked to other actors on the podcast, it seems like those that have become successful, you look for something that they have in common. And I really don't think it's a knack for inhabiting a character. I think it's a fearlessness.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just basically the people who say, hey, I'm going to cover my head in scotch tape and I'm just going to go in there and do
it. Yes.
And if I blow it, who cares?
Yes. Tom, I've taught my whole career too. I started teaching 2 weeks after landing in Australia. I started teaching at the university. I started teaching what they called vocal dynamics. Just was a fluke, but they called and they figured that because of this big degree I had that I knew what I was doing. It was the worst, course study I had at Cornell, but I went, whatever. That's the other thing is, can you tap dance? Sure. You go out
in the
alley, $5 and someone shows you a step. That was the school I was from. Sure, fine. So what I found is that as a teacher, if I could teach confidence, that would be the last thing I'd ever teach. And we talked about this, and you certainly the poster boy for commitment to choice, which is confidence. And the thing about confidence is what erodes – I've never known anybody that was confident and fearful at the same time, even Woody Allen. He's mm-hmm. confident, and then he plays a fearful person. And fear is general, and it is the greatest enemy of all performers, because performing is an unnatural act. You get up in front of people and say, not only am I going to amuse you and you're going to laugh, but you're going to pay for it. I mean, come on. And it's unnatural to be in front of people and behave. It's natural to lie, but not in front of a bunch of people. The pressure gets on. And so FDR was right when he said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Fear is general, and it overcomes us. And if we don't approach it specifically, because then we can't address it, because relaxation is a skill. But what happens is fear creates tension, robs us of that default we seldom get, and that's relaxation. But I've never had a great – well, I have had times in my life where I had more fear. Almost – I don't know about you, but once doing a monologue for something, I almost buckled over. My knees started shaking, my legs. You ever get there?
Oh, sure.
Right. Fortunately, I'm not a real brain trust, right? People say, what's your secret to success? Fast and shallow. No, I don't get a whole lot. I'm smart, but I went to Cornell. I know smart people, and they're a lot smarter than I am. So I don't see things like, do you realize that if you lost a line in front of this person right now, you'd ruin your career? I don't see those things. And so that's helpful, by the way, a little modicum of ignorance. But what happens is that we need to address fear, because it's general and it will – ruin you, because to be connected with the way you think and feel and act and move all gets hinky when you're afraid. It's like we have this part in our reptilian brain where we go, there's a woolly mammoth behind me, poop and run. And you're only capable of the concentration to get through it. Well, that won't get you booked. It doesn't get you jobs.
It won't get you the job.
No.
It just won't get you the job.
You got to be able – see, I was just had a student before you came here Raleigh Jackson Jones, who is Jim Cummings' daughter and very talented. And I was talking to her about they don't want best. They can't see best. They want good and different. Not indifferent. Good and different. And the cutting edge to different is being you. And Steve Mackle once said, he's a voiceover performer and a writer. He comes from a writing area, so he's real smart about that area. He said, make the difference between you and the guys in front of you and behind you the sound of your mind. They want an actor with a mind. And so in order to use your mind and go, hey, maybe it'd be better if I went, meh, instead of, I don't know. Maybe you should go in the script, go, oh, better for the character. That takes mind. It takes mind to be able to think those things. That's why, I mean, all my career for years, and didn't you have this? You come back from an audition and you'd be in the car going, he walked down the street. What? He walked down the street? Why did I say it?
Oh, of course. The best auditions are always driving home from the audition.
I call them windshield auditions. Mm-hmm. If I could peel off the invisible layers of auditions I've had in that car.
Sure.
It's like why my Hamlet's so good in my living room.
Exactly. But as you know, but as we talked about, all you can do is go in there, be as fearless as you can be,
right,
and just swing for the fence.
Well, here's the thing. You might have a better idea. And I actually drove back once to an audition because I said, doggone it, it's so good. Went back, did the audition. And they looked at me like frozen stare and went, thank you.
When you did it again.
Yeah.
A friend of mine did the same thing and said, I was waiting for him.
Yeah.
Because I had been in, and he goes in and he just was so, I blew it. I didn't do anything I was planning. So I, being a genius, said, well, you know, I mean, if you're that upset, he says, I'm going to do it. So he goes back. I didn't do something that I had planned to do, and I wonder if you'd just give me the opportunity to try it again and everything. You know, door closes. He does it again. He comes out. We're walking to the elevator. He says, that was a huge mistake.
Here's where it taps into your concept of performance, and certainly audition, is that you go in and you totally commit. Because here's the thing. You may have a better idea in the car going back, but if you go in with a worldly dumb choice but commit to it, it's better than the most brilliant, clever choice that's not completely committed to.
I really think in
you can make bad ideas swing with commitment.
I think heart will get the job over technical mastery every time.
Yeah, and even clever.
Yeah.
And I think clever is good. Clever with a K, that's getting caught. But clever is very good because, yeah. because as Chuck Bloor, one of my mentors, said, performance is truth and tricks. It's not just truth. Every so often you have to do something that's clever that they're amused by, and then you can get back to truth. But you got to get their attention every so often.
Absolutely.
Those attention-getting things are very good, but going back to this concept of commitment, and I think that going back to my Scotch tape, not only would he do anything we told him, but for someone to be able to put Scotch tape on their face and commit to it and not go, look, I have Scotch tape on my face, because I just forgot about the Scotch tape. That's done. Now I can act.
Right.
That's what I think was impressive is an actor's ability to commit. And, of course, commitment comes in confidence. And the great thing about commitment and confidence is you can't be wrong. I mean, no, you can't be bad. If you think about, you know, like Paul Lynde, I only do dead people now, by the way, Hamlet. To be or not to be, that's the question. He wouldn't be bad.
Right.
He might be wrong. Or Nicholson as Hamlet. Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I. I mean, I want to see it.
Yeah, yeah.
And my example for years would be, imagine Dean Martin doing Hamlet. He could not be bad. He would maybe wrong.
But it would be Dean Martin doing Hamlet.
And it would be good.
Yeah.
All those guys, anybody with a distinctive style and ability to commit is never going to look bad. And oftentimes they're very good because it's off-the-nose casting. They're good and different.
Mm-hmm. When you came back to America, were you mostly a voice person? Were you still doing theater? Were you teaching mostly?
Well, here's what happened. I learned voiceover in Australia. They called the theater and they asked for somebody to do a Jimmy Cagney impression. I went in, and in theater, I was not very good. I was okay. I never got bad reviews, never got good reviews. Chekhov, French Fedot, farce, Le Biche, oh, I was great. Because I grew up around the deaf, and my family were the deaf. I was always comfortable with exaggeration. But when they did the Chekhov, the pilot light would go off, Tom.
Mm.
It was too subtle for me to connect to. Because, you know, most people, they connect to subtlety and like less exaggerated and struggle with exaggeration. I was exactly the opposite.
But as Tom Smothers told me once, you know, subtlety is the first cousin of boredom.
I get it. This reminds me of somebody. For years, I was, you know, a little too clever as an actor in school. And my instructors go, Fraley, you're going to die of clever. Here lies Fraley. He died of clever. So I had this whole thing about don't be clever.
Meaning right. There's a little bit of shtick, meaning the audience can see the upraised right. eyebrow a bit too
it's,
much?
It's like a magician that shows the magic and mm-hmm. it's no longer magic, right? So clever is a little – clever. Let's call it clever with a K. It's a little too clever. So what happened was years later, because I struggled with it I said, is that choice too clever to the director? And he went, Pat, come here. He said, too clever is what unemployed actors tell employed actors.
Well, so that's very true.
Yeah, it really balanced it. So I definitely take moments in a script, but not too many, where I can do a good, interesting choice.
A little flourish,
Let me give you an example. Say you're supposed to play a sleazy guy, okay? Okay, here's say what happened to Bob, and I'll give you a good, truthful choice that's not clever.
Pat, what happened to Bob?
Well, I killed him. Okay, now let me give you a choice that's truthful, but it has a little trick in it.
Hey, Pat, what happened to Bob?
Well, I killed him.
It's just kind of whatever the...
It's like he had a runny nose or well, I killed him.
Yeah, just a little.
And he cleans his tooth.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, just a little flourish.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it's put in the right place, you don't get caught and they're dazzled. Uh-huh. And then you go back. Don't do too many. Don't do another one in the next sentence.
No.
I'll tell you where I learned that, or because of Marlon Brando. I at a certain point in my career, I thought, if I can understand this guy, I'll understand how an entire style of acting in the 20th century changed. Because it wasn't method. It wasn't Lee Strasberg, Uta Hagen, Stella Adler. It was Brando, that one man that changed the course of the most accepted style, and that's realism.
Yes. In On the Waterfront, he's talking to Eva Marie Saint.
Oh, yeah.
And he takes her glove.
That's fallen on the ground.
And he starts putting her glove on his hand.
Now, let me tell you what Ed Asner, my buddy, told me about that. He said, can you remember the dialogue during that sequence? And I said, well, no. And he said, he could have been giving away nuclear secrets. No one knows. It was so powerful, a thematic thing. Another one, just look at the structure of, Streetcar Named Desire. When he was on stage with Jessica Tandy, who was a little bit high-strung anyway, and she was playing Blanche, right, Dubois.
Okay.
At the beginning, he had a line like, there's a cat back on the fence or something, right? And he would somehow, this is the example of one of them, he'd change every night. He went, oh, there's a cat back on the fence. And scare the heck out of her. And everyone knew, oh, it's Brando by then, because he'd done Truck Stop and a couple things. But then, oh, they all sat up. Oh, Brando, he's so interesting. Then he would play truth. No tricks, anything, until he got to Stella, which was an incredible choice for the time. Now, think of Godfather. He's not doing much at the beginning of the movie. Then he jumps out of his chair, slaps Johnny Fontaine, and goes, you get the gush, you cry, which was a singularly strange choice.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's got our attention. Then he goes through the entire movie, doesn't do anything tricky, all truth, until he puts that orange in his mouth.
Yeah, in his thing, with his grandson.
Which is the strangest choice ever made by any actor, and he pulls it off because we love that. But you see how he bookend tricks to get our attention? So it reminds me that no one goes to a magic show and then goes backstage and went, you tricked me. I want my money back.
Right, right.
We want to be tricked, and that's wonderful trickery. And I suppose calling it a trick makes it less than what it is, because some of them can be completely organic and interesting, like sighing through a line going, well, Bob, you needed killing. And I suppose you call that a trick. It's a pretty organic trick, but that's what I mean. Something that's interesting.
So when did you come back to America? What year?
I was over there 2 years.
Okay.
Learned how to do voiceover.
Uh-huh.
Realized that was a great place. Because, by the way, going back to this first job where I did the Jimmy Cagney, as I walked out of the studio, being paid the same amount, $75 a strain in those days, for a week doing Shakespeare. Like that balance.
Right.
One of the guys went, oh, we like you. And I went, what? Really? Why? And he said, oh, you're so big, we can't get the other actors to be that big. And I went, oh, really? Something I've struggled with all my life, and now it's a plus. So I started looking. In those days, they were doing a lot of character voice work on radio commercials. You know, the chairman, psychologist, and the cowboys. And
mm-hmm.
So I came back to the States, took a job up in my hometown of Seattle, as a character or as a creative director in ad agency, make enough money to come to L.A. And I had a contact. Here's another thing about, being discovered. I was discovered, but I was ready. So, hey, I'll give you a shot. Boom, I was ready. And I started working at Hanna-Barbera in the late 70s doing Scooby-Doo villains. And I was off and running.
And that's pretty much a straight line to now, huh?
Yes. Well,
teaching.
Teaching the whole time, more and more as I got older and the animation changed and they didn't want so many wild and woolly older guys. They became more target focused like tweenagers, selling mm-hmm. a show. For years it was like the kids will like this and the adults will like it too, The Tick. Things like that where there's so many levels
to
the show. And also getting old. I mean, we don't work as much because how many grumpy grandfathers do you need,
right? Yeah.
There's one. or what I always like to think of is the generals on games. There's always one general to tell them all to go die.
Right.
All right, right. Men, I want you to go out there.
Yeah.
Right? And, of course, the difficult news is it's hard to get a job because there's older guys and they're all, you know, up for the same part. The good news is when you get it, you don't hurt yourself. Like all the young actors, they have to go out there and they get killed and they're screaming and losing their throats. Here's how an old guy dies. All right, I want you to go out there, man. What the heck? My arm is... They just have a little mini coma, little stroke, and you're gone.
You and I...
So I work less than I did. I would say in the 80s and 90s, I was the, you know, lead in every bad animation TV show they had. And now I have like one line in the best movies made. And it's kind of it reminds me of what Sir Alec Guinness said. He said, one becomes knighted so one can go to Hollywood to play butlers.
Yes.
It's a change.
Yes.
It's a change in your career, and it's welcomed in a lot of ways. And also, I've been blessed to have this flourishing teaching career, and I've always loved both. I could not trade one for the other ever. So it's not like I fell into it because I needed to. It was more like it just came along and got stronger as I got older. And I got a little wisdom.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because the body's gone.
Yeah.
You know that.
No, we met in the very earliest times that I was going in voiceover sessions, the first jobs that I had, you were in the room.
That was in the 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah, early 90s, I suppose. Yeah. And
we were in a show with Dana Delaney, Mark Hamill, Elliot Gould.
Yes.
Malcolm McDowell. We didn't see many of those guys because they came in. But that was a star-studded show, and then there was us.
And then there was us.
Yeah.
But what amazed me, because coming, you know, as I did for so many years, decades in stand-up comedy, was the very free, fun, goofing off attitude.
Oh boy!
That you were a major part of,
right.
Which was great with me,
right?
Because it's sort of for me that was the basis of a creative environment,
right?
Was everybody joking, being ready to do it at a professional level,
right.
When we're on a take,
right.
But really being free and
well,
everything.
You know, comedy, you can't sink down to low energy and then jump up and get there. And so that's why Rob Paulsen is so brilliant. Not only is he brilliant in front of the microphone, but he would buoy the room.
Well, that's
between
the thing,
takes, and
it never stops.
Yeah, but the thing is great is the directors that were really good always let that go. Mm-hmm. In fact, I remember being in the booth once with a really good director, Ginny McSwain, who's the best, in my opinion. But it was somebody like that. They knew what was going on. Somebody came up, or the engineer said, let's start rolling now. And she said, wait, because she was listening from the control room into the booth with the actors. Someone was telling a joke. She waited for it to fall and the punchline, and she says, now we can go.
Bang, and let's action.
Because that's so much – so important. Mm-hmm. And being naughty. Being a little bit naughty.
Being naughty was interesting because I remember – well, if she's a fabulous actress. But there was a day that Jessica Walters came. There were all these guest actors.
Uh-huh.
And to come into that environment as an actor with wide experience.
Right.
Who had been in everything. But to come into a voiceover session with a bunch of like – we were like crazy marmosets. I mean, just climbing on the walls.
It was
walls.
Like that cabin scene from the Marx Brothers.
Yeah, and just the person is sitting there, this fabulous actress,
right.
But saying, what kind of an insane asylum?
Well, it was
is
overwhelming.
This?
Also, for most actors that wonderful actors that are on camera that come into that world, they're overwhelmed at the level of skills because, you know, no one's getting a job because they're good looking and they're dating the producer.
No.
Everyone in those days was they were delivering three characters in a 22-and-a-half-minute show that sounded different. And so you go in and not only are there 12 people that are brilliant, but there's like 36 characters they're hearing. So
right.
it was overwhelming for me at 30 when I came to town and I would sit around. I was there with Dawes Butler and Don Messick and Frank Welker and Joan Gerber and Rip Taylor. These people were – it was Michael Bell.
Mm-hmm.
I just went, whoa. I don't know if I'm
well,
ready.
That I've said it before in the podcast with Sue Blue I had on, but I think that's what people don't factor in. The level of the level of professionalism and talent that it takes for someone to be to appear to be goofing off, do something very funny, and then have the director say, I need it like 0.05% yeah. louder, and you need to take like about a second and a half off of it.
Yeah.
And they do it.
Right, right. They're very technically versed, but it's a so that was I got to tell you this one thing that's in my head. I was once playing Lily Tomlin's father. She was Edith Ann in a special. And at the same studio that we worked in over by the freeway.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what it was called. But and Bonnie Hunt was my wife. And so I'm sitting between these two women, which are pretty crazy. And they're, you know. And so it's in the middle of, well, we're recording and we're recording the whole show. And Bob Kurtz was the director. And Bonnie Hunt goes, oh, it's horrible, it's horrible, oh, it's horrible. And we stop, and Bob goes, what, you're doing fine. And she has her hands in her, or her head in her hands. She goes, no, not me, Lily. Just so wrong, just yeah. to get a laugh out of somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot, that would buoy. And you're right about stand-up comedians and people that come from a different world fitting in better, if they can act. The only difficulty about stand-up is if they can interact.
Well, that's the challenge to many stand-ups.
Here's what happened with Brad Garrett. To this day, he says, oh, you mentored me, right? Because he started getting into cartoons after I'd been there for about 10 years. He's about 10 years younger than I am. So he came in as a young man to do a show called Hulk Hogan Rock and Wrestling, you know, art project, right? I was Hillbilly
yeah,
Jim.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, really. Hillbilly Jim. Hillbilly Jim, you know. It was a, you know, bad Deke show, but he got in and he said, you mentored me. And I tried to figure out how he got that. Well, here's the simple thing I did. I just said, I just encouraged him in so many words and just my response to do what he had done on the road opening for Frank Sinatra. And he's a very funny guy.
Very funny. Yeah.
And I said, do the same thing in here. You see, in that, and by encouraging him, by laughing at him, and by teasing him, and having him, that's how he. It was so valuable to him, just to go. You're one of us. Good. Be stupid.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
In order to let him play.
Absolutely. Say what you're doing out there is brilliant, and do the same thing in here. Have fun. Change lines. Be silly.
Now, I got to let you go soon. You've been very kind with your time. But I do want to add, because I'm a guy with four children
uh-huh.
who's been married forever into Hollywood, this crazy place. You're a guy who had four children with your wife
right.
who's been in this crazy business.
Right.
And people come to me all the time, say, like, how on earth do you do that? Are you like, it's like you're living in Kansas City and you work in an office or something, but you live in this insane
yeah.
Place. So
yeah.
how did you do it? Or why? Were you always kind of the guy, I'm going to get married?
No. I was like, I had no idea, and it's always been show business and performance. But I met my wife when we were 19 in junior college, and she was the most the funniest, which means she's smart. You don't have dumb people that are funny. It comes with. She was funny and the most attractive woman that I'd ever seen, and I knew I won't see anybody this beautiful again. And so – you know, we were married about 10 years later. So, but she is very down to earth and grounded. She understands what I do because she has an art background, and she was there when I was a young man planning to be an actor. But she'll do things like, I'll go, I got a real important audition at Warner Brothers, and I'll get to the door, and she'll go, well, don't come home if you don't get it.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Or, this is funny, she'd I always said she was the only woman that could divide a SAG contract by shoes. Well, that's 2.5 pairs of shoes.
Right, right.
It just has a never really very down to earth, although very capable in urban circumstances, because we've been in a lot of black tie things and very, you know, out with stars and stuff, and she's very comfortable. Just a very centered woman. And I think it's just a great center of character. Plus, we have our faith. We're both – I became a Christian. We both in the 80s, and that served us so well with some of the challenges that we've had personally in our lives. We lost we lost our firstborn at 24, and I had never had my faith tested before. And I was surprised at how important that was and how valuable it was for – because, boy, do I understand why people – kill themselves with their lose a son, cannot no longer work, are devastated completely.
And he was 24?
He was 24,
and
yeah.
How did he die?
He died of a drug overdose. Uh-huh. He'd struggled with drugs for about 4 years, and it took him. But, you know, with our faith, we know where he is, and that gave us a peace beyond understanding. But so the centeredness comes from my leaning on my mate and her being such a wonderful mate, and also our faith.
Could you the amazing thing to me, Pat, is your ability to be funny.
Oh, after
something
that,
like that happens in your life.
I lost my lightness after that. I lost the ability to, you know, because after all, we are poster boys for escaping reality, really making a commitment to our lives to not deal with as little reality as possible in what we do for a living. So the thing is, I lost my ability to escape reality. I mean, he used to give me a Charlie Chan movie and a box of ginger snaps and I'm gone.
Right, right.
I lost that. So I lost a lightness to me. Mm-hmm. And I used to be known as a very carefree guy. Well, I'm not carefree anymore. I'm still funny. It's a little darker, but I can't explain what it is. I think part of it is you're born – I'm not talking about people that play comedy. I mean, Ed Asner's he's not a funny guy, but he can play comedy all day long. So there's a skill at playing it. But coming up with it, like Brad Garrett. Brad Garrett is a fountain of comedy because of his point of view of the world. And that's what I was born with. We have a point of view. When I see your show, I saw your show the other day, and particularly it points it out because we're both clean comedians or clean comics. Because I always thought, well, it's easy to be dirty. I know what that is. It's funny. But to do it without being is really points to, oh, you're born with it. And you work it because you were, you know, you've shared with me how you started being funny. It's based in a reality and a reaction to something. And so I think that's just a gift and, well, a blessing and a curse because you get in trouble for comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've had all your life, but you see a different view of the world and it's turned a little and you comment on it. Unfortunately, I don't know about you, but it makes me distanced. I've never gone to a concert where I felt like I'm part of the group. I'm always watching a little. And so there is that sadness that I've never really been fully on with the group. I'm always looking at it a little bit and distanced.
Isn't that the artist, though?
Yeah.
Isn't that the artist?
Not only comedy, but
right,
the artist.
I mean everything.
You mentioned Remington and Russell.
Yeah.
Our greatest Western, and Bierstadt, greatest Western
painters. Uh-huh.
Right. Well, guess what? They were Easterners. Bierstadt was Swiss.
Right,
and so
right.
They were out, like, watching. Go ahead and brand. I'll just paint this. It's very nice, but the smell of the fur is bad, but go ahead.
Well, I guess that's true, isn't it?
They were not
cowboys. You needed an outsider to show the West, like, it's romantic quality.
Well, not only romantic, to get into romance.
Look what I see.
Yeah, you get into romance to and also the truth. Perfect example, again, is Ed. Ed Asner grew up a Kansas City Jew. And his father was the junkyard man. And so he used to tell me I was double distanced. So he becomes the poster boy for goy grump.
Uh-huh.
Lou Grant's a goy. And he knew what grumpy was like because he watched it. He was in it but not of it. So this Midwest – and the funny part, I just saw him in his play on Broadway, Grace, with Paul Rudd.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Rudd is a Midwest Jew. And look at how good he is to show what a guy's like in his 40s. He knows all about it. But I don't know if he'd have that artistry without being distanced slightly.
Mm-hmm. Now, I just wanted to ask you.
That's pretty heady, isn't it?
It is heady.
That's
and I don't mean to get too heady on the podcast.
Oh, we've
but
already
it's
lost
stuff
them.
That, yeah.
There's
it's
four
stuff
crickets.
That interests me. The edge to you now, that the little slice that is a little bit of darkness.
Yeah.
That is now a part of your character,
mm-hmm.
and maybe a part of mine. Maybe it comes with age, and maybe it comes with just seeing a lot of things and experiencing them. But is that – what am I trying to ask?
I'm in the amusement business. In Greek, amuse means not think. So I give people a time when they're not thinking. And I know that Bob Hope tapped into this. when he was entertaining boys in Tarawa, before they went to Tarawa, that next day, I think, 10,000 of them, I think, died. I could be way off on that, but it was huge numbers. And he knew this was the last thing they'd have. And that's when you tap into real meaning and or entertaining kids at the hospital. You bump into some things that make amusement valuable. Yes, and humor, a teaching tour, depending on what you're teaching. And so I'm chewing at the edges of this, but – and it really –
No, I think I asked it badly, as I often do. I think my question – I guess –
I don't think
are you
God
making peace with a slice of pie that's dark? Are you making peace with that? Are you kind of – are you becoming okay now with being that guy and not the guy before?
Well, it's like any loss. Let's talk about the guy before. The guy before, again, I don't think whether I was – that's really part of what God wanted me to be. Certainly when I was not doing anything wrong and I wasn't crude or rude, I was fine. But then as I move on I look at a lot of liberty in my faith. If it's contrary to God's plan, that's called sin, all right? If it's not that, you got a lot of room to move. And I think that as long as my darkness, it also the dark humor, I have to do with my wife, Brad, Garrett, you, I have to be careful because I don't want to offend someone. But it's lurking there, and I think that it's part of my liberty. And it's a way that I can laugh at some things that are so difficult in the world. You know this.
Well, listen, I'll let you go, Pat. But one thing I try to do with people of your experience, certainly of your teaching and everything for so many decades, is as you well know, and as I know, especially in the business, people come to you
yeah.
and say, "Listen to this." I could, "Hey, I have a big foot." But when a young person comes to you and says, "I want in."
Right.
I want to be your helper here, an
right.
intern or whatever. I
right.
want to take a class. You teach.
Yeah.
You know, what are a couple things you tell them right off the bat?
I encourage everyone because you can't tell some people that seem to have modest talent, you know, which is the skill gift from God. You just get it. You just have it. You can't tell where that'll take them versus someone that has modest talent and is really has a work ethic. So I encourage them. To go ahead and try it because, you know, my journey has been going somewhere I never dreamt I'd go. And so I say, you know, try it. Go ahead and try it. And I try to hook them up with some teachers that teach more beginning because I teach more advanced and stuff to get them going, get their feet wet.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, why not? I mean, when somebody says, show business is really competitive. I mean, try to get a job at the post office. That's all over.
Right, right.
We have one of the best jobs ever because we don't get fired.
Yeah.
So try anything. Connect. Listen to the best. Try to connect with teachers and ask them questions. Yeah, I always do that.
Now, where can people find you? On the web or
yeah.
somewhere? You have
patfraley.com.
PatFraley.com.
And there's a free lesson page. And anybody that's interested in character voices or doing commercials or even audiobooks, I have a gaggle of free lessons. You don't have to subscribe or anything. Just click on them and listen or watch them. That'll get you going.
Yeah, Pat, I've been such a big fan and a friend for so many years.
See, I didn't know you were a big fan.
Huh?
I love that.
I like your particularly early work. You know, then, you know, I don't know. Numbers of years ago, it seemed like it was becoming kind of rote. It seemed like you were mailing it in. But early on, I mean, that early stuff when we were bantering back and forth,
yeah,
when it was
that
creative,
was
that was great,
that
great
was good.
Stuff. But thanks so much. Thanks so much for being on. I appreciate
it.
Very much.
It reminds me of Earl Boone, who was an actor, and he's retired now in Hawaii. And he got out of an audition. He goes, I don't know. They didn't go for it. And I said, Earl, look, they love the facile outside, that interesting way that you can perform. They love that. It's the inside heart of you, the heart that your mother loves, that they hate.
He didn't laugh.
No. Yeah, I thought it was funny. Was that too dark?
It
was
no,
too
dark. No, it's not dark at
not
all.
Not for you.
For me. You kidding me? Sheesh. mine. Many thanks to Pat Fraley. And check out his website. Actually, for a lot of people who approach me interested about voice, maybe you don't want to do it professionally. It's just interesting. He has lessons on there and everything, patfraley.com. Thanks for downloading the podcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Emily Wilson for all her help producing. Thanks to Chris, Katie, everybody over at Nerdist. Thanks to McPherson Guitars for helping me on my live show. The live show is going well. Get out there and see me. You're going to have a good time. But thanks for tuning in. And please tell a friend, consider subscribing, and we'll talk to you next time.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.